Roots of Modern America, a podcast on history and how we became who we are. I'm Will Thomas, and I'm joined by Andy Graybill. Our subject today is race and violence, a comparison of the post-Civil War West and South.
Yeah, I'm glad we're here today to talk about how these two different areas are linked by pretty horrific violence against non-white groups in the post-Civil War period. African Americans in the U.S. South, Indians in the West, and to think with you, Will, about what that says about the expansionist ambitions of the U.S. during this post-Civil War and Reconstruction period.
That's right. Our initial focus, our starting point, really, is a subject of your present research, the Marias Massacre. Now, this event took place in the winter in 1870. It's not very well known. It rarely appears in U.S. history textbooks, and yet it was significant for the West. It was significant for U.S. Interests abroad and its diplomatic relations with Canada particularly, but England as well. It was significant for the way Americans understood, white Americans understood, the Indian, what they called the Indian Wars. Now, Andy, the New York Times in February 1870 called this event, quote, a sickening slaughter. And the Daily Bulletin of San Francisco called it, quote, a cruel and indiscriminate slaughter. What happened, and where did this start?
Well, you have to go back to August 1869, although the massacre itself took place in late January 1870. It was the murder of rancher and fur trader Malcolm Clark on his ranch just outside of Helena in August 1869 that really set in motion the events that led to the Marias Massacre. Clark was a fur trader who had moved west to take a job at the American Fur Company in the 1840s. He'd married a Blackfoot woman, and they had had several children together who were of mixed Native and white ancestry. Clark had been pretty well received into the tribe. He'd been a very successful trader. But he had retired and was living on a ranch outside of Helena. He was murdered.
How common was Clark's experience?
At this time and place, the thing that makes him stand out is how successful he was. There were many white men who came west at this time, adventurers, entrepreneurs, and so forth. And Clark certainly had both of those qualities. But he became much more successful than the average Anglo trapper who went west to the Rocky Mountains or to the Southwest during this period, which is why he was so notable.
How about his intermarriage? How common was that, and his acceptance into the Blackfeet?
Very common. This was basically relationships between white men and Indian women on the frontier. Very common. Kit Carson certainly comes to mind in the book by Hampton Sides, Blood and Thunder, is all about, in many ways, Carson's exploits in the West. And Clark, very similar tradition. And his relationship with his wife named Koth Kokona, that's her pagan name, was very typical. He married her sometime in the early 1840s in a lot of ways to solidify a trading relationship between her father's band, which was very powerful, and the American Fur Company.
Okay. And so this man is a successful local figure, and he's murdered.
Yes. He's murdered for reasons that remain unclear. I'm hoping to dig a little more deeply into that in my research. But because he was so prominent, he'd helped negotiate some treaties between the U.S. government and the Blackfeet. He was somebody of note to Americans and Indians in the area, so his murder was not going to go by unacknowledged. But also it took place against escalating tensions between Anglos, who were coming west from the U.S. into the Montana Territory, and various Indian groups in the region, particularly the Blackfeet, who were very resistant to outsiders who were in trying to exploit the gold fields there that were crowding out Indians on Indian land. Clark is murdered at his ranch in 1869 in front of his family. And at that point, the local leaders, and particularly the U.S. Army brass there, Al Sully and Reginald de Trobriand, decide they need to pursue a two-part strategy. One, to try to get the perpetrator of the murder, a guy named Pete Owlchild, turned over to their custody, but also preparing for war. And when the Indians don't produce Owlchild because they don't really have it in their power to do so, the Army brass sends Colonel Eugene Baker out into the field, and on January 23rd, 1870, at dawn, he and his a collection of 300 both soldiers and concerned citizens open fire on a peaceful Blackfeet winter camp.
So Andy, why is this a massacre?
And not say a battle? Well, for a couple of reasons. The most significant one being that this band of Indians who were camped at the Big Bend and the Marias in north central Montana were unaware of the approaching cavalry detachment. As the troopers found out later on, this was a camp where all the men had gone out hunting, chasing what stray, scarce buffalo they could find. So it was a camp of old men, women, and children. And on top of that, they were especially defenseless because many of them were suffering from smallpox. There had been a smallpox epidemic starting in 1869 that had made its way up the plains and reached Montana. So this was a group that was huddled down in temperatures that ranged somewhere between 20 and 40 below zero on the banks of the Marias, oblivious to the presence of this cavalry detachment perched on the bluffs over them, who opened fire under the command of Colonel Baker, who was almost certainly drunk at the time, as were probably very many under his command. And the Indians didn't have a chance, and they descended upon them afterwards and killed any of the wounded and stragglers they found in the camp. The army and concerned citizens who joined them lost a grand total of one individual, whereas the Indians suffered at least 173 dead, and probably more like 217, which was a count made by several Indians in the wake of the slaughter.
Many of those who were killed were women and children, and many of them were killed without defending themselves. They were simply massacred. So what is the army? Why was the army sent in to this region, and what was it was supposed to do?
Well, in this particular case, it did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was to end pagan resistance in Montana. Montana was coveted at that time, both for its agricultural possibilities, but most immediately at that time because of its mineral deposits, gold and silver. And the U.S. government, as it had in various locations throughout the West, the Black Hills and western South Dakota, which happens later, wanted control of those lands. And to do so, they needed to suppress Indian resistance. And the pagans had been striking back in small numbers and in small skirmishes throughout the 1860s against white incursion. This brought a quick and final end to that.
Now, so in much of the West, General Philip Sheridan, who was in charge of the entire military district and who had given the orders to Sully and others, in fact, his orders were to, quote, strike them hard.
That's what he tells Colonel Baker, strike
right.
them hard.
Strike them hard. I want to come back to that because it has a bearing on Sheridan's Civil War experience, where he comes up with that sense of striking them hard. But in any case, Sheridan and Baker in the West were in many newspapers lauded in the West as heroes. Idaho, a newspaper, urged both Sheridan and Baker and the military in general to, quote, kill and roast the Indians, to kill, quote, so the accursed race may cease to propagate. How could this be sanctioned, this killing of women and children?
Well, I think it goes, or ties back directly to the context. Namely, you have these low-level skirmishes that often resulted in, you know, a handful of deaths here or there, Indians murdering whites and vice versa, and usually the whites were the aggressors. Then it would provoke Indian retaliation and the cycle would start up again. But I think for frontier residents, there was a belief that Indians were subhuman, and also that if Montana was ever going to be a productive part of the United States, to be fully incorporated, these, quote, savage ways and savage people had to be either brought under heel or exterminated. And you hear and read some, you know, really just pretty chilling rhetoric about the idea of crushing nits while they are in their chrysalis state, which of course is used to justify the murder of infants and children so they don't grow up to be Indian warriors or to reproduce, which is truly on the minds of a number of folks, certainly in Montana and elsewhere throughout the West, to try to bring an end to these Indian races, or to at least put them firmly under the boot of the United States.
So why is this event largely been forgotten?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one of the things that really attracted me to it when I first read about it in fictional form in Fool's Crow, a novel by James Welch, based on the historical novel, but it talks about this event I'd never heard of. It's certainly overshadowed by Sand Creek in 1864 in Colorado, Ouachita, which was one of Custer's first, maybe his first important victory in the Indian Wars, and then even Wounded Knee in 1890, Massacre on the Marias, the Baker Massacre. It's called both of those interchangeably. Indians call it the Bear River Massacre, which was their name for the Marias, is largely forgotten. I don't know why that is, particularly because I think it does belong in the same breath with any of those other more famous slaughters. But it has some long-lasting significance. The most important development for U.S. Indian policy generally is that President Grant, who was horrified by this and how it seemed to contradict the tenets of his peace policy, made it a practice to no longer put reservations and Indian groups under the control of military authorities and instead to use white religious reformers to direct Indian reservation boarding schools and reservation life more generally.
Well, I want to come back to Sheridan's strike them hard comment, because I think this goes back to his Civil War experience and this event coming really on the heels of the Civil War, and of course the U.S. expansion into the West being at the same time as the Civil War in large part, make this an important connection. Sheridan, of course, is most well known for his hard policy, his hard war policy, as historians have been calling it, directed at the Shenandoah Valley, and Custer was involved in that. And this idea of a hard war policy, I was struck in hearing you describe this event and in thinking about it for today, about some kind of elements of consistency between what took place in the Civil War and what was taking place in the West. What took place in the South and what took place in the West. And this hard war policy is a kind of consistent theme. During the Civil War, Sheridan and others, Grant and Sherman in particular, who is also in command of the Army in 1870, but there are some elements of consistency to this policy. I mean, one is that is the role, I think, of gender and of women in the thinking of these military commanders or of many Americans. The women of an oppressed or racially different group, or the women of the South in the case of the Civil War, they were despised. Despised for carrying their beliefs, despised for encouraging their men, despised for their political voices, especially if they were of a lower class from the officers. There's this sense I'm trying to come to terms with this killing of women and children. This violence is deemed. It's sanctioned if it's directed at this kind of lower race or lower class or very different, and especially toward women in those groups.
I think it's a really interesting idea that does indeed link these two regions at this time. And I again, you're much more familiar with the historiography of the Civil War than I, but I do think that you can relate these two places of violence in that way, and they're linked by total war. The idea that in order to conquer these areas, to reconquer the South and to absorb the West, there will have to be a campaign of violence that is unflinching in some ways in order to make sure that the United States not only prevails but is able to kind of expand its borders.
Well, the idea of the hard war policy is undermining the basis of material life of a civilization, of destroying its homes, of burning its food supplies, of collapsing its society, largely by controlling and taking over its necessities, what it needs to survive. And this was practiced in parts of the South. It was the genesis, really, of Sherman's campaign and of Sheridan's campaign, and then brought into the West. I suppose that might be too strong of a statement, that it was brought into the West. It may be that the two reinforced themselves at the same time, that these are going on simultaneously, you know. But there's another aspect to this that I wanted to explore with you, and that is the idea of what is a savage. I'm seeing in my research the designation of Southern guerrillas as savages, as outside the bounds of civilized warfare. And there was a great deal of discussion in the Civil War about what exactly constituted civilized warfare. I mean, we're all familiar with the Civil War general George McClellan, whose chivalrous sense of civil war, of warfare, was what prevented him from sending any of his men practically into battle and losing any blood at all in a campaign. But there were limits. There was an understanding about what constituted civilized warfare. And often in the press, in the northern press during the war, the Southern guerrillas are described as savages, as having gone into a kind of barbarous warfare akin to Indians. And the comparison is almost direct. And that these groups needed to be dealt with very differently.
What's interesting about that is, what happens then when the war is over? Because what do you do with people who look like you? They may speak a little bit differently, but I'm very curious. It's very easy to cast the Indians as savages because they looked and behaved and spoke different languages. They were so different from white Americans. I'm curious, how do those ideas either sort of remain, or do they simply disappear after you have this period of reconciliation? How is it possible, in other words, how tenable is it to try to other somebody who is white and a citizen of the same nation, at least up until the point where the South secedes?
Right. This is in this period of Reconstruction, a very important dimension to this story. The white South could object to Northern Indian policy as, in a way, hypocritical, as an extension of Yankee expansionism and Yankee violence. At the same time, the white South could gain Northern sympathy for problems dealing with race, for the problems of race and violence as a means to subjugate a lower race, in their case, African Americans, is what white Southerners pointed to as their problem that they were uniquely positioned to address, and demonstrating that by pointing directly at Northern views on Indian policy.
Did they ever find any traction? I mean, did people in the North ever sort of see the circumstances as being remotely analogous, or was there real resistance in the North to sort of seeing that the Indian problem in the North and in the West was somehow comparable to the problem of African Americans in the South?
Well, it seems to me they were often discussed separately, but they were deeply connected because what Americans were experiencing was a massive expansion of the state, of the country, into these regions, and an increasing sense of racial difference and what that meant for policy. And, of course, these were connected.
Well, I think there's another way in which they're connected as well, which is that a number of pretty prominent abolitionists after the end of the war, I'm thinking of Frederick Douglass, I'm thinking of William Lloyd Garrison, turned their attention in the late 1860s and early 1870s to the question of violence against Indians in the West. And there's a huge hue and cry in New York shortly after the word of the massacre, the Baker Massacre, reaches places like Boston, Philadelphia, and New York City, about what to do, which prompts this whole span of editorials that you let off the podcast by reading from. And I think there's a way in which abolitionists at least made the leap from the problems facing African Americans in the slaveholding South to the problems of Indians in the post-Civil War West. But I guess what I'm wondering is whether that was ever, whether that ever found sort of footing in the Northern public as a whole. And I don't know the answer to that question yet. I may come across some of that in my research, but I wonder if that ever had as much traction with people, with the populace, with the Northern populace more generally. Was there an Uncle Tom's Cabin, I guess, for the Indian problem in the West?
Well, of course, Helen Hunt Jackson's A Century of Dishonor is widely thought of in those terms, and I think that white Americans, North and South, had more commonality or increased commonality, especially in the Democratic Party, but increasingly even in the Republican Party, on the issue of understanding themselves as civilized, refined, middle class, aspiring, and therefore separate from the what the Democratic press called the barbarous Negro in the South, the consistent Reconstruction depiction of African Americans as subhuman, as a race unfit for government, and so by the 1880s and 1890s, the experience of the Indian Wars was consistent with that that experience in Reconstruction for many white Americans, who saw things in these terms, saw both of these regional stories aligning in a way, and that commonality is going to be very important for American sense of its position in the world as well, coming into McKinley's administration and Theodore Roosevelt and others. I'd like finally to ask you about why. What do you think violence like this? What are its roots? Where does it come from? I mean, you've told us about a murder. You've told us about very local events, but we've gone from the local to the national and global here in our perspective. How can we pull these things together?
Well, speaking from the perspective of my research in mid to late 19th century Montana, I think ultimately the root source of the violence in the West is based ultimately on competition for resources. I think that there are exacerbating factors, certainly differences of race, culture, language, what have you. And I think those are, as I said, kind of exacerbating tensions, but ultimately what brings people in the West into conflict, Indians and the expanding American state, is question of land and the resources contained on the land. And that ultimately is what leads Anglos to go west to Montana, and what leads Indians to resist their incursions, or their desires to protect the dwindling bison herds, to protect their land from American prospectors and so forth. And so it's ultimately, I don't want to sound too much like a Marxist reductionist here and saying it's all about the money, but I do think that power over resources and access to resources ultimately is what in the West, and I think this is true in what historian Richard Maxwell Brown calls the Western Civil War of Incorporation, which many scholars don't find particularly useful concept. I do. I will claim that rather proudly. I think it's probably, as with any large framework, it's got places where it applies more than others, but I think it generally is a persuasive framework to understand people resisting the expansion of a capitalist economy rooted in private property and acquisition. And that brings groups into direct conflict, direct and sustained conflict in the West during this period, I think. Does that accord at all? I think about the South, and I basically think about race or violence in the South being predicated almost entirely on race and the legacies of slavery. But I don't know, how does that jive at all, the idea that there could be sort of an economic component to this which is enduring?
Well, of course, slavery was an economic as well as social institution, and heavily economic in its exploitation, and so at the heart of it is certainly an issue of the ideas about property rights and about labor and what terms labor can work under, and the racial composition of the labor force. Those are all absolutely at the heart of Southern violence. But a lot of Southern violence in this period is directly political. African Americans in the Reconstruction era claiming first-class citizenship, claiming citizenship, period. And that citizenship claim is met with violence because it has political consequences. Now, much of that political consequence has economic consequences as well, but I don't think it's quite the same as the resource competition you're describing in the West.
And I don't want to boil it down only to a matter of resources, because very clearly, from the very beginnings of English settlement in what becomes New England and down to the Chesapeake, there are horrific encounters between Indians and whites. Think about the Pequot War, for instance, that comes to mind. So there's clearly a legacy of conflict in between Europeans and then Euro-Americans and Aboriginal inhabitants of the continent.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for talking with us today. And we've enjoyed the conversation. And we hope we'll talk again on the roots of modern America. The Roots of Modern America is produced at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, Nebraska.